Hello from Lahinch, County Clare. Rory McKiernan here, author of Hitching for Hope and host of the Love and Courage podcast. And you're very welcome to the Creative Souls of Clare podcast. In this episode, I'm joined by my good friend, Tony Griffin. Tony, originally from Ballyea, County Clare, is a writer, speaker, co-founder of the SOAR Foundation, which does amazing youth empowerment work throughout Ireland. And he's also a former sports star who played hurling for his native County Clare. And he's the recipient of a prestigious GAA All-Star Award. I talked to Tony about his autobiography, Screaming at the Sky, and his new book, The Teenager's Book of Life. And we explore his own childhood, his teenage years, his days playing for Clare, his charity cycle across Canada, his views on what it means to live a good life and a creative life, and lots more as well. Thanks to Creative Ireland for the support for this podcast and to all who continue to share, rate, review and support the podcast in different ways. So here we go. Let's get going with this conversation with Tony Griffin. Tony Griffin, you're very welcome to the podcast and congratulations. We're recording this on the launch day of your new book. How are you feeling about the launch and everything?
I'm feeling good. I'm glad it's here. It feels like it's been a long time coming, even though it's only been 8 months. So I'm glad it's here.
Yeah, you were saying to me that, you know, relatively speaking, it's been a fast enough turnaround time from conception to, well, it's interesting when I use the word conception there, you're talking 8 months. Let's call it 9 months for conception's sake.
Yeah.
And you've birthed this new baby. But like, my hunch is that it's been much more. It's been the guts of 40 years for you, because this is a piece of work that's come out of you from perhaps when you were a teenager yourself, and this is part of a continuing journey. Would I be right in any way?
Yeah, it has felt that. Your hunch is correct. Yeah, like it took, say, 9 months to physically actually sit and write, but as everything in it comes, has its origin story much earlier. There's parts in the book that I'd forgotten I even remembered until I sat down. And yeah, I tell people when they say, ask me about the book, I say it took me probably 40 years to write a book in 9 months. So your hunch is spot on.
And so, like, if we imagine this book now working its way into the world, it'll travel whatever way it needs to travel, and eventually 13, 14, 17-year-olds will get their hands on it. Can you take me back to Tony Griffin in County Clare as a 15-year-old and what was going on in your head and in your life at that point, and how a book like this maybe could have been a support to you, and what were the things that you actually needed in your life that maybe you didn't have?
I thought about that a lot, because I wrote a lot of the book from that place, from that 15-year-old. So that meant, you know, gathering photographs that I asked my mother to put together of that period in my life, and really staring at the photographs and trying to connect with what it was like to be that age, because we forget, and as we go on, we're not thinking that much about how it felt back then. We just move on. So Tony at that age was, everyone called him Anthony. And I was starting to be known as a fellow who played hurling, and then Tony was used. I kind of didn't choose it. It was kind of given to me. And at that age, I was probably stretching. I went from like 5'7" to 6'2", almost like overnight. So I was extremely self-conscious of my weight. Everyone called me skinny. Every skinny word you can think of, I was called it by mates and not mates. So really conscious of how I looked, my body shape. I felt weak. I felt small. I felt that, you know, that I was the only one in the world that had these insecurities. But on the outside, I was a jokey, mad about sport, consumed everything to do with sport. And I had lots of dreams and ambitions about playing for Clare, where I was from. And they weren't exactly met with welcoming ears by people, because where I was from, someone hadn't done that before. So Tony at that age was quite unsure, very sensitive, very ambitious, and beginning to have a sense that maybe a lot of stuff I was going to need to find a way to do on my own. That my parents were wonderful people, but they had seven children. I had to find a way to do it my own way. And that started from, I think, 15, probably earlier, 13, 14, where I said, if this is going to happen, I'm going to need to do it.
Is this a classic case where the tribe or the village raises you as best you can, and eventually the young man needs to emerge as their own individual, their own self, and that the tribe can potentially hold them back as well as nurture them.
Yeah, like I think the tribe hadn't really a clue what to do. And so in our community, it was built around, you know, Mass on a Sunday, GA, and my father was big into farming. So it was quite a basic, in some ways, it was just a very simple, like people probably will laugh at this, but like there was a river beside our school, our national school, and a few of us used to set lines in the morning, fishing lines now. And and we'd come back after school or we'd sneak out at lunch and check our lines, and we'd walk home with three or four small brown trout. Like this isn't 1950, like this is 1991 or two, around the time of World Cup 19.
Wow.
So we used to camp out by that river and fish, and you know, regularly come home with three or four small little brown trout under arm, and then skin them and cook them ourselves. And it was a really like Huckleberry Finn type of upbringing. When I turned 13, I started playing with Claire, and I often say that from 14 onwards, I didn't enjoy hurling because it came with a lot of pressure. Most of it self-placed. So the community, I think, just did what the community do. I probably realized early on that this isn't going to be where I spend my life. But that was scary because I didn't know, well, where will I go? And I didn't know a lot of people like me, if I'm honest, who were, you know, talking about dreams and at 17, getting a motivational tape off a fella and listening to him saying, this is the shit, like, this is it. And my friends going, what are you talking about? Like, we're trying to get a porn mag and you're talking about these motivational tapes. So I probably did feel a little bit of an oddball, even though I was well able to fit in and
yeah.
Be a chameleon.
Do you still feel like an oddball?
No, because I found, you talk about the village being the tribe. I found my tribe in a way over the years. And now I realize that, you know, that's kind of what life is about, finding like-minded souls. So I don't, but there's certainly times where I felt that way as an adult, for sure. Yeah. Like writing the book was almost like my battle cry against whatever, I don't know. But the book, it has got that energy flowing through it, which is, it's all about being your own human being while you're here.
Yeah, yeah. I'm fascinated between that dance between the being your own man or your own human and then still belonging to a tribe of whatever form. And maybe you can belong to multiple tribes as well, you know, because like I kind of resonate with that idyllic upbringing, whilst I'm now jealous we didn't have fishing in our lunch breaks, but certainly fishing was a big part of it. And I used to hang out in tree houses and be fishing all the time and hanging out in woods and ring forts. And like, it's an amazing privilege, really, isn't it? Yeah. To have that and the safety of it as well.
Massive safety. Like, you know, it's a thing that I think a lot of kids, everything's so structured now for kids and teenagers, like, and even more so with COVID, has to be really, you know, organized. Whereas the freedom we had was, as I say, we camp out for 2-3 nights. And I've never remember my parents asking, who are you going with, or how long are you going to be, or where are you? Never. We just wandered. We were like free range hens, like pecking around Ballyhea, and you know, and then getting interest in a few girls in Clarecastle, which was the next village, and we go in there for our camping trips, and it was like going to New York, like yeah. You know, walking into Times Square, like the village in Clarecastle. Wow, there's a girl I haven't seen at Mass. Oh my God. So it was like this world that opened up. And my mother was great. She was very open-minded. Like I had a speech impediment. You wouldn't think this, but until I was like 4 and a half, I didn't speak any normal English. I had this little made-up language. And she was brilliant because she got me into reading when I was around 4 to develop my speech, and would religiously, even though she had 7 kids, make me sit down and read with her. And you know, I think that she was brilliant that way, very open-minded.
And do you ever think back about that speech challenge that you had, and that there may have been something else going on there, or do you read too much into it? Or,
well, it's funny you say, like, I often think I didn't really want to be here for a while. Like, I think I just didn't really, I didn't land in myself for a while. And maybe that was a bit of it, because, yeah, like I broke my femur when I was 2 and a half. My mother often talks about how, when she'd go to visit me after her night shift of work, I might not be in my little bed. This is when they got the traction off. And I'd be gone into the usually older folks part of the hospital talking to people. And I was like probably crawling, you know, or a bit bizarre. But yeah, I was always a bit of a curious questioner.
Do you think, I think we've had a conversation along these lines before of the whole potential realm of past lives and souls, and that sometimes children can say what are perceived as strange, unusual, mad things, but that it seems that they maybe are connected to some previous or current intelligence, and there's something else going on that we somehow have amnesia about as we grow up.
I'm a complete believer in that. I have no doubt about that. Like, I remember our son Jerome driving, I was driving with him one day, and he starts saying, he goes, oh yeah, I met your, because my father died in 2005. So he said, oh, I met your dad in heaven. And I said, what? And he goes, yeah, I met him. He was in this room and I was in the, and he starts describing in real detail, probably three at the time, meeting my father. And I was like trying to get my phone out to record it and sent to my brothers and sisters. And I have no doubt about that. Like, there's definitely an amnesia that occurs, but there's also some carryover from where we were before this, that in young people or in kids especially, is still turned on.
It really sort of is a challenge to the contemporary mind that, you know, we're only dancing with a fraction of what's there, perhaps, you know.
Yeah, but that's changing. I think even that's one of the major reasons why I talk in a very secular way about your soul in the book, is because that is just another word for that other intelligence. But, you know, our brains are incredible organs, but they're also very, very limited. And they're so primed by the belief systems of the village. So when you start to realize that it's all actually a fable agreed upon, then you start looking at things in a very different way.
Do you think in another period, another time, different circumstances, you could end up being a priest or something?
Ah, yeah. Like, I've been to a shaman who told me that in my past life, my mother's Scottish, and this shaman didn't know this. And she said, one of your past lives was in one of the most deprived, socially deprived parts of Glasgow, working with the different masons to build schools for children. And, you know, I that just made sense to me. Like, I didn't doubt her for a second, because I said, Gorbals of Scotland, that makes sense. My mother's from not far from there. And that stuff has carried over into this life. Now, this lady didn't know what I did in this life. So, yeah, it's probably coded in there somewhere for sure. And this is just another iteration of that type of life.
Yeah. You can put that in the CV there, 2,000 years ago.
Yeah. Stole from the rich.
Robin Hood of Glasgow. So, Tony, you mentioned both your mother and your father, and we're obviously recording this by video and it'll be available as an audio version, but I can see a photo behind you in the camera, and I think that might be your father with you as a young man. Am I right?
Yeah, that's a wedding in Scotland. He wouldn't have been the type to throw his arms around you. He was from a different time. But at this wedding in Scotland, that a cousin getting married, my mother took a photo and he put his arm around me. But there was this other guy in the photo. You can't see it. It's been cut out. And he was a big, gregarious Scotsman with a kilt and a purple kind of top on and silk. And he got his face in the picture and made this silly face. So my mother got him cut out. And I love that photo because my father is beaming in it. And he has the arm around me and I have my arm around him, you know.
Odd.
Rare.
There's very, always very one rare of those Muppets, isn't there?
And we thought, we said, ah, oh, Jesus.
And little did he know that this was going to be a very special moment that, you know, has. So I'd imagine that photo is very important to you.
Yeah, like, you talk about accessing other realms, dimensions, whatever you want to call it. And everyone has their own way. And some people don't and some people do. My way, I suppose, will be, especially writing the book, was I had a photograph of him. I had a photograph of my granny in Scotland holding me when I was very, very young. And I just had those adorning where I wrote. And sometimes I'd sit down and say, right, what do you want me to write about? What's the piece today? And then after a few minutes, it would just come. So I think they're all with us, you know. And I talk about that in the book. We're not alone.
Yeah, it's interesting because so many cultures traditionally all over the world since the beginning of time have had a connection with the whole realm of ancestry and ancestors. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be somewhat erased or removed from modern, at least what we call Western culture. There isn't mm-hmm. necessarily the same notion. We might give the odd nod to somebody that came before us, but it sort of leaves us. And it's almost that there's a, I wonder, is there an arrogance to think that we're all it, you know, that we're not standing on the shoulders of all those people?
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know, is it an arrogance, but I can see what you mean, but it's definitely not the full story. You know, you go to Australia, you hear the indigenous people talk about the elders that walk the land, same in Native American. Mm. Now, the wisdom in those cultures is so profound. It's almost like we're just remembering our own form of that wisdom, our own Celtic wisdom, but it's definitely coming back in. But here, look, it was kept at bay for so long, and that's just the way things are, but it can't disappear. That energy will just move again.
Yeah, so that idea of it being kept at bay, like that suggests like somebody was keeping at bay, and we probably don't want to get too far down this rabbit hole, but like, you know, certain institutions or ways of thinking have interests in keeping us flowing on one channel and blocking out other channels, like that you can only listen to one station on the radio versus, you know, a bit of jazz, a bit of hip hop, a bit of trad. But do you think we're in that moment now where we can start to listen to other radio stations and see which one we like?
Yeah, I think it's an inevitable progression. Like, fear is a powerful thing. And those individuals that were leading the charge in those organizations you talk about, they were doing what they thought was the right thing. And they were doing their best as well. And what I love about what's happening now is people have more choice to decide what radio station they want to listen to. And that can only be a good thing. Like, silence and one-dimensional way of looking at things has never done us any good. So it's just time. The time has come where people have choice.
Yeah, I had two reactions to what you just said there about, excuse me, those individuals doing their best. First of all, I felt that's tremendous empathy and tremendous kind of non-judgmentalism, or to kind of just take that broader view. But then part of me went, you know, where do you kind of allow for the fact that there are people that misuse power and seek power for their own gain? And I mean, do you sort of don't go there as such and sort of keep focusing on the light. Is that your view on it, or how do you approach that?
No, like, I have compassion because I think that, I suppose that compassion maybe is coming from looking at it from the higher perspective that we were looking at it. But on the human perspective, no, I wouldn't stand for the misuse of power. You know, I played sport for a long time and I met so many bullies. I could fill Croke Park with the amount of bullies I met, especially when I was younger, who told me about what they were going to do to me. I'm going to break your hand before this game is over. I'm going to break both your hands. And I learned pretty quickly that most of them, they were saying that because they were bullies. The guy that would break your hand wouldn't tell you he was going to do it. He'd just do it or try to do it. So I learned quickly, maybe 16, 17, that not everyone's going to do me a favor. Not everyone's nice. Not everyone's got good intentions, regardless of where those intentions come from. So you've got to face the bully, whatever form it comes in.
That's very interesting, Tony. So these people, I mean, I'm not so naive to think that sort of sledging and dark chat doesn't go on at every level of sport, but like, was this very prevalent in county hurling, like inter-county hurling?
More so at club. At county hurling, guys know that kind of shit just doesn't wash because, you know, the intimidation doesn't really work. But at club level, when I was younger and I was playing with older men who maybe I was 16, 17, they were in their late 20s, especially when I was starting to make a little bit of a name for myself, they would tell you. I remember one guy from Cork in a club game, we played him in a club game, saying to me, look, the way this is going to work, Tony, is I give you 1 or 2 points, but don't you dare try and embarrass me. You know? And I was like 19 going, no, I'm definitely going to try and embarrass you. That's absolutely what I'm going to try to do because all I can do is run. And I'll run everywhere I can. But club level, you get a lot of that. But like, look, when my father died, within Clare, I remember playing club games where fellas would like be saying, they'd be walking past me after I'd miss a shot, say, and they'd say, geez, your father would be so ashamed of you right now. And stuff like this, you know, and, you know, that kind of stuff goes on, but usually it's at a lower level. But as I say, come back to your point about the abuse of power. You can have compassion, but some bullies, you just have to stand up to them.
Mm. So can you trace much of, I mean, we're obviously talking about ancestors, and then we've talked about a little bit about your father, and then you've mentioned your mother. I mean, what have been their direct influences on you as a person now? What are the attributes that you can track back to your upbringing and some of the values that maybe both or each of your parents have handed to you?
Yeah, it's always a hard question to answer, because a lot of them you don't even know. Like, you can't take them out and say, oh, there's that one, and then there's definitely that one. But, you know, my father, they were very different people in some ways, but they were wonderful parents. Like, my father was extremely hardworking, massively. Like, he died of asbestosis at 67 due to the environment he worked in. So I think the values he embodied were work ethic, honesty. He never, like, I've never met a more honest person. But he was also, and I've only realized this in later years, he was also very wise. Didn't go to school past primary school, you know, would ride a pony down to national school and tighten a field and go to school. But all he wanted to be was out farming, and he loved nature. He was a very wise man for a man that didn't necessarily, was never really educated.
Well, there's not necessarily a correlation between it, is there? Okay. Yeah.
He just understood things, and he did a great way of connecting with people. My mother, on the other hand, you know, she grew up in Scotland, grew up in an environment where, I suppose, there was that Protestant Catholic divide, wanted to get away from that, came to Ireland, went from a nice upbringing, not nice upbringing, she had a very challenging upbringing in some ways, but a nice setup in Scotland where they lived, to Ireland, where they had no inside bathroom, and had to build that on in, build an extension, did a lot of work to do. And she was terribly homesick. But I think what she gave us was, she would stand up to the bully. She was brilliant at standing up to the bully. And in whatever form, maybe that's in small-mindedness, or, like, I'll tell you a really quick one. She came to Ballyhea, rural place, and she decided to throw a birthday party for my oldest sister and invited all the other kids, and they all came, and she went, sent them home a little bag of sweets. And then the following Sunday at Mass, this old gent calls her over and asks, can he have a word? And he goes, look at Mrs. Griffin, we don't do that kind of thing around here. We have our own parties in our own house. We don't be doing that kind of thing. So when it was my brother's party a few months later, or whoever's it was a few months later, she did it again. And that's kind of her. She stood up, very open-minded, very bright, you know, great poet, even though she wouldn't admit it. And I think from her, I definitely got that willingness to stand up for what's right. But also, she is very, you know, artistic, creative, and I'd say I got some of those genes, luckily. But hard work, and I suppose doing the right thing, being honest, were really strong ethics that they would have just lived.
They're hardy people, like, you know.
Hard. 7 kids, working night shifts in a hospital, working construction during the day, coming home, feeding those kids, putting them all through university. Yeah, they were great people.
Sometimes I think, you know, every generation certainly has its challenges, but, you know, it can do no harm to reflect on some of the challenges that others have been through, and, you know, the no toilet and all of that. And, you know, even the fact that hopefully health and safety measures and workers' rights have improved to prevent, you know, what your dad went through and things like that. But obviously these battles continue in other forms.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So Tony, just when we go back to the drive to kind of succeed at sport, and then you ended up at college in Nova Scotia, which is New Scotland in Canada. Yeah. And then you were doing these epic, famous fly home missions that took you, what, a guts of 18 hours more to get home to play a match.
Yeah.
like that's a serious fire. That's serious drive. Mm. Have you ever sort of sat back and said, what is driving the drive?
Yeah, it's funny. Only this week I had a conversation with Brian Penny, who's an amazing guy. For those that don't know him, he was a heroin addict and has since written a book about his experiences and has gone and done a PhD. And we were talking about this, and he was saying that he discovered through his recovery that a lot of addiction is around unmet needs. And he was saying his greatest need was driving a lot of his addiction. So I really thought about that, and I realized what my need probably unmet need probably was for approval. And you know, when you make the clear team at 14, and that's what's celebrated in the village, there's great approval in that. But then you go on, you play for the seniors, and you play in an All-Ireland final, amazing approval. And I think that was probably unknown to me, the fuel that drove a lot of what I did. But there's a gift and a curse in that, because it comes with a lot of pressure as well. Geez, I better not mess up. I'll let all these people down, I'll let myself down. My whole identity will crash. So when my father died, it really caused me to question, well, who am I? You know, it's almost like I didn't have him to that approval any longer. He wasn't there to give it to me. So I kind of started thinking about other things, and then I did the cycle across Canada, but that really for me was trying to prove to myself that I was strong enough to do it. So I think that whole sport, all that, probably a lot of it was seeking approval from people. Like, I was 40 this year, and only recently I sat down and I said, the thing I've done that's got no seeking approval has been the Teenager's Book of Life, because I was... My manifesto for it was be daringly honest and write to young people not to please anyone. So, you know, there's some song that freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. And I think not needing the approval of others has been just a wake up call for me, because it's so kind of like, it's like an underground river. It's there so long that it's when you start to see it, you see it everywhere. So that's why I'm proud of the book, because I know in it there's not one ounce of, I hope you like this, or do you like it? It's like, here it is.
Yeah, it's a great place to get to. So many people I've had conversations with on the podcast and elsewhere, people that are quite often a lot older, that the one thing that it really gets my ears kind of pricked is that when they talk about, you know, not necessarily caring what people think of them. And it's, a lot of people would like to think that that's the case for them, but when it boils down, like, as a 1-year-old, 2-year-old, 3-year-old, on we go, teenagers into your 20s, into your 30s, 40s, so often that's what we're about. The clothes we wear, the haircuts we have, whatever it is, it's really a tremendous point of liberation to find a way to break out of that. That's a real beautiful touch point to turn 40 and to have gifted yourself that sense, and then to start re-gifting that out to others.
Yeah, and a lot of these things are hard won. The day after I submitted the book, my lung collapsed, and I'd had this before, as you well know, because you were such a support while I was in hospital. And, you know, my wife was a support. You were, Susan, your wife, so many people were. But when I was in James's and I'd had the surgery, there was a day I had an infection. I was just looking out the window. It was a Saturday, and they thought it might be COVID that I'd contracted. So they put me in this tiny little isolation room, and I was there for maybe 6-7 hours on my own. I remember just looking out the window and saying, Tony, no one can come in here and make this easier. You know, no one's going to make this pass. Like, no one can come in and take this away from me. And I think I spoke to you about this since. I had this epiphany that I'm on my own, and we're all on our own in terms of what we're going through. And yes, you can reach out and others can help you. But for me personally, something clicked in my head, which was like, you don't need anyone's approval, because ultimately you're who you are facing each day. Like, I know I'm not making sense with this, but it made sense at the time. And what it's given me is this independence of the good opinion of others, which has been liberating. And I hope I hold on to it.
Yeah.
Do you like my jumper? Do you like my jumper?
Yeah. So for those that are listening in audio form, Tony's wearing an exquisite yellow jumper that he's clearly quite proud of.
I'm so glad you approve of my jumper.
I very much approve of the jumper and the yellow underpants that you're wearing, matching it, yeah. No doubt. Yeah. So, Tony, we talked a little bit about sport and, you know, the cycle against Canada, or against Canada, the cycle through Canada. In many ways, it probably was against Canada because you were mountains and so on.
In the prairies of Saskatchewan. For 4 or 5 days, it definitely felt like it was against the country.
Yeah, you must have met some real moments of facing yourself there by actually facing the mountain in front of you.
Every day.
Mm.
In different ways. Because we'd fundraiser every fifth day in different cities across Canada. So it wasn't like I could say, do you know what, just take a day off today. Because that would mean I'd have to do double the next day. So it was like, it was so relentless and so stunning. Like some parts like Manitoba and Saskatchewan were just so unforgiving, and then the rain would stop and the sun would come out and it'd be like heaven, and then the Rockies were different. It was unbelievable looking back.
Wow, what an experience. And obviously that's documented in your book, Screaming at the Sky. So just when you talked about there, that, you know, those moments where you push hard and you like to take a day off, have you got better at that, at taking a day off, or is that a luxury, or how does
I had to, because I had a breakdown after the cycle. So I realized, like, that was my first, I suppose, humbling experience of, whoa, I'm not Superman. And yeah, I can do all this stuff in hurling, and then I can do this cycle and everyone tells me I'm great, but I'm actually as fragile as the next person. I need a little bit of TLC from time to time. So I went through a very difficult patch. It was a dark, dark 18 months, really. But I don't think I learned my lesson fully. I think these things come back again and you say, you didn't get it. You're going to have to go through it again.
So you described that as a breakdown and it lasted roughly 18 months. What form did it take and what did you do in the 18 months?
Well, how it started was to give people some context, I'd done the cycle. We'd raised probably half to three quarters of a million during it, giving it away. Came back to Ireland and spent a month or 6 weeks here and then went back to finish my last year at university in Nova Scotia. And it was the volume of exhaustion and fatigue. So I started with, you know, not feeling comfortable in lectures, just feeling like almost like I was itchy. Then not wanting to go in, then not wanting to leave my room. You know, then I realized I'd never even heard of the word depression, but I looked it up one day and I said, that's me. That's describing me. So it got, you know, I didn't talk to anyone about it. I just tried to get on with it. I started drinking a bit too much and more than I would have. And then one evening I was walking home from a lecture. I had an exam the next day. I felt under such pressure and I saw a bus coming down the street. It was like slushy because it was around December, real slushy. And the bus was coming down the street and I just said to myself, that's the answer. And I stepped out onto the street when it was maybe 20 meters away. And then just as it was getting closer, I just jumped a step back and it frightened me. I said, what happened there? So I rang my sister, one of my sisters I'd be very close with, and said, look, I'm not well. There's something, I'm not myself, talk through it. And then I just went to a counselor and the first one didn't match me. Second one didn't. And then I found a woman back in Ireland, who just was a lifesaver. And started going to her and I realized there was a lot of things I hadn't addressed or thought about or given the due significance that they were and had been. And that was a great experience because it kind of brought me back to myself, but it was like gradual. It wasn't like, that's it, two sessions done. Because I was still playing for Clare, still going out playing in front of 40, 50,000 people, but having a panic attack the day before. So it was a gradual process, Rory, of probably best part of 18 months, 2 years before I was able to look at it in the rearview mirror and see it maybe for what it was. But it shaped what I did with SOAR, and that's in the book. So it's strange. All these things, they are linked and they are part of the same piece of music. You just don't know it at the time.
You find that there's often a mirage with what's perceived to be success, and that people, whether it be in sport or business, politics, whatever it is, they look like they're maybe at the top of their game And people might look in and say, well, he has it all, kind of. Mm. And then there's that lad who had a panic attack the day before the match.
Yeah.
You find that amongst people, because you are connected to a lot of high flyers in different worlds.
Yeah, it's so funny when we say he has it all. What's all?
But that's what I mean by the mirage.
Yeah, well, that's the mirage. Because I remember we played Watford in 2008. And the week before, we went to train on the pitch that we'd be playing on. And I just felt like I thought I was having a heart attack. Like, I was so naive to all of this stuff. I didn't even know what that was. But yeah, having to race for the changing rooms and go into the bathroom on my own just to let myself calm down. Then went out and played the following week, you know, on the same pitch. So people may think that, but I definitely have come to believe something that if you look at it at a soul level, going back to where we were earlier in the conversation for a moment, that we're here for our soul to kind of, you know, evolve and develop. So when we come into our lives, that's success. It is a mirage, because really the important thing is how much is your soul growing? How much is your soul actually adding to its capacity? So if you're at the top of whatever ladder you're at the top of, you're not going to learn a lot about that. But you will learn when you slide and fall off the ladder and have to start again. And I think that's after the cycle, I learned about the humility of respecting the fact that I'm not Superman and no one is. And just to be mindful of that as I go along.
Mm. Very well put. So we haven't talked much about SOAR at all, or at all, rather. And, you know, it's been a huge part of your life, and it was the period just before you started work on the book. But in many ways was probably a lot of what became the contents of the book. The fact that you've worked with thousands upon thousands of teenagers and have created something with others that has gone on to create spaces for all these young people and the ripple effects in their lives. What do you feel about that journey now, and what was it like to build this organization and to then leave it?
Yeah, oh, it was hard to build it. Like, even you talking about building it, I just feel this lead weight fall over my eyelids, because you know yourself, you've been there, and Jesus, you were instrumental in helping me when I started at SOAR, but I had no knowledge whatsoever of working with young people. Well, that's not true, I suppose. I trained a lot of young people in a hurling context, but I had no knowledge. But I had a fire in me after that breakdown. You know, I'd approached the GPA in 2009 and tried to get a movement for men's health off the ground, men's mental and emotional health. And we were talking to the HSC, it was quite advanced. And then the GFC hit and they said there was no money. So I shelved it. But then heard about Jim Steins and his work in Melbourne. And it was just like the big finger saying, come on, this is it. But I wasn't in the right place, because I had no finance, no money and no job and all that. And I was engaged. But it just found its own way, I suppose, in a lot of ways. Met people like you who guided me. And the longer I went in SOAR, to answer your question, and I was there for 9-10 years, the further I got away from the part that I loved. And towards the end, the last 2 years, it was like the cycle all over again. I was just enduring to get to wherever the next stage was, because I didn't want to just walk away. I needed to finish it out in a way that there was an organization when I left. So once I had done that, I said, right, it's time for me to leave. And plus, the guys needed to hear a new voice. And you know, we were having a family, we wanted to buy a house, but unfortunately you can't do that on the CEO's wage of an organization like SOAR, even though it's doing such immense work. So I had to move on, and I thought I was joining the corporate world, but I went to my first one or two trainings or workshops in different parts of the world with these like high level execs. And I sat in the back of the room saying, this is not me. But I didn't know what was me. I had jumped off this moving train, which was SOAR, thinking I was jumping onto a corporate training train, and realized this is just not going to work for me. So I had the obvious self-doubt about, well, what is? And then someone said to me, what would you really do if you didn't need to earn a living? And I said, I'd write. And they said, right, okay, all you need to do is earn enough the next 6 months to see how far you can bring writing. That's what I did. And the book is a result.
So there's obviously there's various choices in these journeys, and like one of them speaks to the whole tension between safety and perceived risk.
Yeah.
You know, that the path we know that we may not enjoy, but it's going to deliver you, you know, the ABC, and the other path, who knows?
Yeah.
But then lo and behold, you trust that calling, and here we are with a book. And yeah,
you learn to contain that calling. Like, you learn to understand that, you know, the cycle, I said, I'm doing it, and that's it. But I was single then, I had no children. Whereas now with a book, I say, I'm going to write this book, or a book, because I was 14,000 words into a different book before this one emerged. And then I said, well, okay, no, got to pay this, got to do that. This has to. So I think hopefully I'm getting a little bit more aware of how you go about following that internal nudge that's telling you this is your direction. Might not be popular with everyone, but this is your direction. And knowing then how to do that in a more, I suppose, rooted, grounded way. At least I think as I turn 40, I'm getting a little bit better at that.
Yeah. So do you feel like that's like honing your skills at navigating intuition and that kind of guiding voice, that you're just becoming a bit more skilled at knowing how to surf on the wave?
Yeah, I think so. I think the surfing is a good analogy, because I think I'm learning how to stand on the board and know I'm going to be okay, you know, and manage the doubt. The doubt's been the greatest wrestle throughout my life, is managing the doubting voice that wants to keep you tied securely within the harbor when you know the choppy waters of the ocean are calling you. I'm getting a little bit smarter. But also, when you start, like, when you know what you know, and you know you can't unknow it. Like, I have worked with a lot of individuals who are corporates, very successful, very wealthy, and very unhappy. And I think you start to realize at a certain point, hold on a second, the game is up. It's that way of it, there only being one way. That's not actually all the full story. So then you have more permission to kind of find your way. But that can take practice. And for a lot of people, it's too scary. And I know why it is. There's a lot of uncertainty. But I suppose everyone's different. And for me, it's the only road for me. It's not because I'm putting the two fingers up to the other road. I have a huge respect for the other road. But for me, the road that's truest to me is the road. My job is to understand that at each stage of my life.
Mm.
If that makes any sense.
No, it does, absolutely. So then, you know, there's the intuitive skill that's required to surf the board on the wave. But presumably then there's also like a preparedness and a logical kind of rational awareness that knows to choose the right board and not go out to sea when it's a full gale storm. So, you know, I suppose what I'm also getting at is the whole realm of income and finance, because the path that you're probably pursuing at the moment just brings more questions and doubt and uncertainty than the other roles that you could have possibly pursued. But you've learned to maybe just live with the uncertainty in the trust that everything will be all right.
Yeah. And, you know, there's this whole thing in sports psychology, or that, like, the success leaves clues. So successful team, if you dig inside the DNA of that team, it's there, the clues are there. And what I have found is the cycle that I did that year was, it actually, okay, the actual physical part was tough going, but the organization of it, things just slotted into place. Same with SOAR. They just slotted. Now, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's not, the work isn't involved in making it happen. It kind of unfolds. The book was the same, meeting Hazel, the illustrator, how we work together. It just, everything fit. Mm. I've come to recognize that as that's the clues that more uncertain path leaves for me. All I've got to do is tune into what those clues are. And when you've seen it once, then you recognize it the next time.
Yeah.
The next time. And the doubt doesn't eat you up then.
Yeah. So in a way, would you say that it's more about finding the flow?
Yeah, totally. Totally. But that's the skill. Like, that's the, you know, the Tao Te Ching talks about that. So many texts, most of which I've never read, that's what I get when I hear people talk about them. And you sense that, like when you've played sports, you've played, you've done music, you understand when there's a flow and it might go in a second. It's the same with, for me, in finding your path. I suppose a lot of it is dependent on knowing yourself. And then you get to know the rhythm of what your flow feels and looks like. And then you don't force the wrong stuff. I think in my past, I probably forced a few things that were the wrong stuff because I was trying for this. It made sense up here, but it was off here. So now it's like getting the two to meet somewhere.
So as well as all of this going on, you have fatherhood. How is fatherhood for you?
That's where I'm getting a serious schooling. Yeah, we have Jerome, who's just turned 6, and Jesse, who's 9 months. And fatherhood's great. Like, my wife is an amazing mother, and I probably don't tell her enough that she is. So I suppose my experience of childhood so far is, or parenthood even, is I feel like the child sometimes because I'm the one learning. What am I supposed to be doing here? But it is tough. I often think, and we've talked about this, with baby, like now both partners do hopefully equal share. It's the sleep deprivation is very difficult. It's very hard to function and do other things when you're walking around like a zombie. And, but it's brilliant. It's brilliant. It's just fantastic. And Jerome has taught me so much. Like Jerome and Jesse are in the book, and there's a running conversation throughout the book between Romy and Bear about how absurd adults are and how insane the world is from a child's perspective. So yeah, they're being taught a lot from those two fellas, and hopefully learning a bit about how to have a lot of crack along the way, because we've a lot of fun, a lot of poo talk. That's the main show in town. Poo and farts, lots of that. Any parent listening will know. Extra boys.
Brilliant. Well, it sort of lightens this idea of carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders and trying to change the world. It's kind of useless if you're not having fun.
Totally.
You know. Yeah.
Oh yeah, oh fuck that old shite of I'm here to change the world. I'm intent on changing my world. Yeah. And we'll see what happens after that.
Yeah. And I often think parenthood and the world of family is the work in so many ways.
Yeah, it's funny because those that don't have children, like I think that sometimes maybe we could support parents more, I think, and just celebrate the fact that that's an incredibly important job. As you say, it's probably the most important job.
Yeah, well, I obviously I don't have children, and you know, every now and then I'll get a comment or an email telling me the great work that I'm doing, you know, and yeah, and then there's other emails that aren't as flattering, perhaps, but. Like it's all relative, isn't it? Like, is a parent that's homeschooling their child during a pandemic and getting up in the middle of the night to clean sheets and hugging them when they're scared, like that's some serious world changing work there, isn't it? So
you're definitely changing that child's world.
Yeah.
Preparing them to change their world and change the worlds around them.
Yeah. Yeah. And hopefully preventing a less damaged soul entering the adult world that needs its pipeline of therapy. And, you know, there's so many damaged people among us and we're all sort of bruised in different parts, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the thing I find that I often think about parenthood is, I remember Kira and I driving home from the hospital with Jerome and we kind of looked at each other and said, geez, they let us go on our own with this thing. and we both half petrified that, geez, we're actually responsible for this.
Oh, you didn't get the license, no.
Well, we were expecting to get like the chip put in our brain that said, this is what you do when, or almost be questioned, are you able to bring this child home? Whereas we're driving down the M50 going, oh my God, this is ours.
Yeah.
We have to take care of this. So, but we're wise beings, like it was done before and we find our ways to do it now. And as you say, during lockdown with all the homeschooling, it just ratchets up the tension and pressure. But hopefully we're finding our way.
Yeah. There's another question that's on my mind, Tony. It's about that world of the fishing line and going to the school. And it does sound like 1950s Ireland or Huckleberry Finn. And I definitely remember elements of that growing up myself. And then the world has changed so dramatically. And most of the world, or much of the world now, lives in urban environments. So maybe that's not an option. But do you think sometimes, you know, there's a lot to be found in just living that simple existence where you just, you know, these days people can't travel, you stay within your locality, and, you know, sometimes, you know, the quest for the bigness in the world is not going to bring any joy or peace or happiness. That there's something about the lives of our parents or their parents that was simpler and brought a bit more contentment in its own right.
That's very, very true. Like the other night, you know, I was saying to myself, the book launches today, I was saying, like, I've been just so at a computer, and I had an hour, Jerome was playing, and we had an hour, and we live in on the Kildare Wicklow border. And I just said, I'm going to go up to the mountains for an hour. And I went up around four, and I walked for maybe an hour and 10 hour and 15 minutes just outside the village of Hollywood up in the hills. And as I was getting out of the car, I went down into the kind of gully in this valley. And I didn't even see them. A group of six deer just jumped out from like woodland, and they were frightened by me, obviously. And they took off across the mountain. But for the next hour, they watched me, and they walked along the skyline. I could see them and all their heads, and they were watching me. And I just walked for an hour. And I remember driving back home. And I said, geez, I feel bigger on the inside now. I don't feel like this small little head, even though people tell me I do have a small head. But I just came back with a new perspective. Now, do I do that enough? No. Is there value in it? Absolutely. It's beyond calculation. And hopefully we will do more of that. I just don't think that the way we were living was the way we needed to live. It wasn't in tune our souls. It wasn't good for our health. And hopefully we might find a new way to have a relationship with the world that we're in, and especially the natural world. So, that's a long roundabout answer with a few deer thrown in. To get out into the mountains, lads, go wild, go fishing, even if you don't know how to fish.
Love it. Well, Tony, it's been an absolute pleasure. Congrats again on the book. May it travel far and wide. And I look forward to catching up in person when the time and conditions allow, and lots of love to all the family, and thanks for the great chat, insights, and stories
in Clare someday soon.
Thanks, Tony.
Bye.
Hello, Rory here again. Thanks for tuning in to the Creative Souls of Clare podcast, and thanks to Tony Griffin for a great conversation. If you enjoyed this episode, please do share it with friends, and be sure to subscribe, rate and review where you can, and do check out the archive of great conversations. If you want to check out my book, Hitching for Hope, A Journey into the Heart and Soul of Ireland, you can find out information over at hitchingforhope.com. That's hitchingforhope.com, including upcoming events and where to buy and order the book as paperback, ebook, or audiobook versions. And do check out also my other podcast, the Love and Courage podcast, for more great conversations. Thanks again for listening. Appreciate all the support, and stay tuned for more episodes coming soon.